Welcome to OnkLive On Air. I'm your host today, Ashling Wehner. OnkLive On Air is a podcast from OnkLive, which provides oncology professionals with the resources and information they need to provide the best patient care. In both digital and print formats, OnkLive covers every angle of oncology practice, from new technology to treatment advances to important regulatory decisions. In today's episode, we had the pleasure of speaking with Sagar Patel, MD, an assistant professor in the Blood and Marrow Transplant Program at the Huntsman Cancer Institute, University of Utah. In our exclusive interview, Dr. Patel joined us to discuss post-transplant complications in myelofibrosis and other myeloid disorders. In particular, he explained the prevalence of these complications and noted the most common ones that may arise in these populations, including primary disease relapse, graft versus host disease, infection, organ toxicity, persistent cytopenias, and immunosuppression. Dr. Patel also emphasized the treatments available for patients who relapse or develop graft versus host disease after transplant, and laid out how graft versus host disease management differs in patients who receive post-transplant cyclophosphamide versus those who receive general graft versus host disease prophylaxis. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Patel, for taking the time to speak with me today on post-transplant complications in myeloid disorders. To start us off, could you explain the prevalence of post-transplant complications in these disorders?
So in general, when we think of post-transplant complications, we really kind of split it into early and late. And this includes different complications. And these include things such as relapse of the primary disease, graft versus host disease, infection, toxicity to various organs, and persistent cytopenias and immunosuppression-related concerns. These things, unfortunately, can be fairly common and very sort of expected part of the post-allogeneic stem cell transplant course.
Could you dive into a little bit more specifically what complications would arise in myelofibrosis?
Myelofibrosis is a myeloproliferative neoplasm, and it's one of the diseases that often ends up being only curable, really, with an allogeneic stem cell transplant. Typically affects patients in their upper 60s as a median age. Unique aspects of that disease includes splenomegaly that they often come in with, and that can impact the donor engraftment. And what essentially happens is the spleen acts like a big sponge, and instead of the stem cells going to the marrow, they end up into the spleen. And so that can cause issues with them engrafting immediately post-transplant. In addition, the marrow itself, as the nature of the disease, becomes fibrotic. And so it becomes a less and less hospitable environment for the stem cells to take. And that can also cause issues with delayed engraftment. And so anytime we have any patient with delayed engraftment as a post-transplant complication, this can unfortunately cause issues where they remain cytopenic, requiring lots of blood transfusions for a period of time. They're also at high risk for infections, given that they'll be neutropenic for an extended duration. Those things in and of themselves are associated with very high mortality. Those first 30 days post-allogeneic transplant for a myelofibrosis patient are very, very critical. And then once they do engraft, you know, it can often be sort of a slower sort of engraftment than we may see in some other type of disease states. And so that also leads to persistent challenges.
What are some of the most common symptoms of graft versus host disease and some of the other complications that clinicians should be aware of and look out for when treating patients?
Graft versus host disease is a complication that occurs in about a third of patients after allogeneic stem cell transplant. And it comes in sort of two flavors, an acute form and a chronic form. And the acute form has traditionally been thought to occur in the first 100 days, where the chronic form is thought to occur in anywhere from day 100 and beyond. Unfortunately, those time markings are somewhat arbitrary, and we're starting to really recognize in the field that there's a lot more overlap and more of a gradation there than a clear sort of line in the sand. The acute graft versus host disease is typically manifested by skin rash, diarrhea, and inflammation around the liver. Chronic graft versus host disease, on the other hand, is typically manifested by dry eyes, dry mouth, skin changes, pulmonary complications. And so they do have a different symptomatology there. And typically both of these diseases, unfortunately, are very impactful on quality of life. And so this is something that's of great importance in the field in trying to both prevent and then come up with new therapeutic options.
How does the timing of transplant affect its success and or the risk of these complications post-transplant?
The timing of transplant and its potential impact on outcomes is something that's, you know, been studied, you know, in various forms. And, you know, for some diseases, this timeline is a lot more clear and there's a bigger evidence base for. So, for example, in patients with AML or high-risk MDS, we know that taking patients to transplant very quickly after they obtain a complete remission, especially for AML patients, more so than the MDS cohort there, is important because we know that long delays before transplant can allow the disease to essentially come back. And that line gets a little murkier in other disease states where it isn't entirely clear when the best time is for transplant. And so that would be, for example, in this myelofibrosis population that I often treat in my practice. And for them, it's often partnership with the referring hematologist to know, you know, when we feel the optimum timing is. Some of that may depend on what availability of donor, and then their response, if any, to sort of front or second line therapies that hematologist may offer. Typically with myelofibrosis, the available agents that exist short of a transplant do not necessarily put them into a complete remission. And so the goals of that treatment are really to improve symptoms and hopefully reduce splenomegaly as well and improve cytopenias. But there's still a lot of variability and debate in that sort of space.
What would you say are the optimal treatments for patients who relapse or develop graft versus host disease after transplant?
For patients who relapse post-transplant, first, we ideally want to prevent that. And so the ways we prevent that are ideally taking people to transplant who are in the deepest remission possible. And then secondarily, really trying to, for where it is applicable and where we do have some data, some patients may have a targetable mutation that we can give them post-transplant maintenance therapy. Usually this is for a lot of the myeloid disorders. And use of things such as like FLT3 inhibitors are an important aspect, can help sort of extract more mileage out of the transplant and prevent relapse. When relapse does occur, one of our strategies is to use something called a donor lymphocyte infusion, DLI, and that can be helpful to basically tip the equation back into favor of having more donor cells on board than recipient. And so that is often sometimes sandwiched with chemotherapy regimens in between. And so, you know, different centers will use different sort of strategies here, but in general, most will try up to 3 doses of this DLI infusion in increasing dose fashion with chemotherapy sometimes sandwiched in between. And that's just one strategy to sort of treat relapse. The other is, depending on the clinical circumstance, to consider doing, again, chemotherapy and then followed by even a second transplant. That's probably less commonly done than the DLI option I mentioned, mostly because most patients, unfortunately, are just not going to be able to tolerate a second allogeneic transplant, given the intensity of it. And so that's sort of how the relapse side of things are treated. In terms of patients who develop GVHD after transplant, the first-line therapy for both acute and chronic is high-dose steroids. And there have been a lot of studies looking at ways to sort of dethrone steroids because the doses that we use unfortunately cause a fair number of side effects as well. And so steroids remain first-line therapy for acute and chronic GVHD. In the second-line space, we do have agents such as ruxolitinib and then extracorporeal photopheresis, ECP. And that's another set of therapies that can be helpful for managing acute graft versus host disease. In chronic GVHD, one of the other sort of newer agents that now has approval is belumosudil, which, you know, I think has interesting promise in terms of being able to manage patients who have been refractory to multiple lines of therapy in the chronic GVHD space. And so this is an area of tons of research and really a huge unmet need remains.
So, you recently published a study investigating the effects of post-transplant cyclophosphamide versus conventional GVHD prophylaxis on transplant patients. So, what did this study reveal about GVHD risk in relation to this treatment?
Yeah, I was happy to be a co-author on this large study that was done through the CABMTR. And what we basically looked at was how post-transplant cyclophosphamide, a backbone of haploidentical transplants, half-match transplants, how does that GVHD look different than the GVHD we see that occurs in patients who have conventional GVHD prophylaxis, which is typically a calcineurin inhibitor such as tacrolimus and in other agents that are typically used in matched related or unrelated donor setting. What this study showed was, first of all, that post-transplant cyclophosphamide actually is very effective and in particular seems to have a better signal in managing patients who have GI GVHD, which can be very difficult to treat and is very symptomatic as these patients can have, liters of diarrhea a day. And so that also then translated into a lower graft versus host disease related non-relapse mortality rate. And so I think that's a very important finding in as we look at, the benefits of this platform versus conventional GVHD prophylaxis. In addition, the other benefits that we saw with this post-transplant cyclophosphamide include the chronic GVHD rates were also lower compared to those patients receiving conventional prophylaxis. And so certainly a benefit there as well. In that chronic GVHD population, the use of post-transplant cyclophosphamide also resulted in a lower non-relapse mortality rate. And so I think there's certainly a lot of notable differences here, and we're learning, really a lot about how the choice of GVHD prophylaxis also impacts the type of GVHD that does manifest if it were to occur. And there is work now in using post-transplant cyclophosphamide out of the haploidentical donor setting and moving it into the matched related donor and unrelated donor settings, which I think will be an important area to see going forward.
Moving forward, is there any ongoing research at the Huntsman Cancer Institute that you're excited about?
Yeah, certainly at our institute, we have a variety of studies that are ongoing and coming up that will be really exciting additions to the hematology space and in particular for my role in transplant and cell therapy. One study in particular is my work that will be looking at reducing relapse rates after allogeneic transplant for myelofibrosis patients. And so our study will be using pegylated interferon to study this. And there's been previous work that has shown in other disease spaces that this can help improve sort of that relapse risk after transplant. And so this study will be a small pilot study, and hopefully, if we see a positive signal, then we'll be able to move that into a broader phase two study thereafter.
So those are all the questions that I have for you today. Is there anything else, though, that you'd like to speak about that we haven't touched on yet?
I think one of the other sort of exciting changes that we're seeing in the allogeneic transplant space in general is the testing of a variety of different novel conditioning treatment platforms. And traditionally, the allogeneic transplants that are done across the world really rely on a backbone of a combination of chemotherapy drugs that have been around for decades. And then that's followed by an infusion of the donor stem cells on day zero. And so a variety of companies, pharmaceutical companies, and others are looking at changing sort of that paradigm. And so at our center, I'm the site PI for the Orca Biosystems ORCA-T study. And essentially, the technology here is to really separate out sort of the T regulatory cells and the T conventional cells and add them back in a staged fashion. And by doing so, to reduce the risk of graft versus host disease from occurring. And so that's something that is ongoing right now and just entered into a phase three format that's currently open across the country.
Thank you so much, Dr. Patel, for speaking with me today.
Yes, absolutely.
That's all we have for today. Thank you for listening to this episode of OncLive on Air. Check back on Mondays and Thursdays for exclusive interviews with leading experts in the oncology field. For more updates in oncology, be sure to visit www.onclive.com and sign up for our e-newsletters. OncLive is also on social media. On Twitter, follow us at OncLive and at OncLiveSOSS. On Facebook, like us at OncLive and OncLive State of the Science Summit, and follow our OncLive page on LinkedIn. If you liked today's episode of OncLive On Air, please consider subscribing to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Amazon Music, and many of your other favorite podcast platforms so you get a notification every time a new episode is posted. While you are there, please take a moment to rate us. Thanks again for listening to OncLive On Air.